we just started talking about magnetism in general terms, and I mentioned that the magnetic interactions, which is the dipole-dipole interaction, is not key to, at least to understanding the general phenomenon of ferromagnetism. It is important for aspects of ferromagnetism like domain structure, right? The fact that ferromagnets are built out of domains comes about primarily because of the dipole-dipole, the actual magnetic interaction, but the fact that it decides to form a ferromagnet in the first place is due to electrostatics, and that's what we're going to talk about today. So I put magnetic in quotes, and to discuss it, I'm going to use a molecule, basically. So there are two, say, protons situated at uppercase R sub A and uppercase R sub B. We are using, whenever we do this, I'll remind you that we're using the Born-Oppenheimer approximation. Which is basically the fact that I actually draw these in the first place and sort of plunk them down in a particular spot, even though I haven't told you how far apart they are, that whole philosophy of approaching the problem is the Born-Oppenheimer approximation. So we just focus on the electron degrees of freedom. There are two electrons, and so I've written the Hamiltonian in a suggestive way. The first line is just focuses on the one electron, and the second line just focuses on the second electron. In my notes, I use uppercase R sub 1 and uppercase R sub 2, but then you might get, it's confusing because I want 1 and 2 to apply to the two electrons. So there's electron 1 and electron 2, and actually I've always found it kind of ironic that we label the electrons for the purpose of making sure you can't label the electrons, because we're going to anti-symmetrize the wave function, which means that you can't distinguish the two electrons. But in the way of formulating that, we actually label them in order to carry that out. So the second line concerns electron 2, and the third line, which is the one we're going to ignore, at least momentarily, is the interaction term. That's the one that causes all the problems. So how do you proceed with two electron wave function? Well, you can have the situation where the spatial part is symmetric. And so you're going to write down psi, let's put a subscript 0 to indicate that you're going to choose the ground state, and you're going to use a product of psi 0 of R1 and psi 0 of R2. So you're putting both electrons in the ground state of this molecule, whatever it is, and if that ground state energy is epsilon zero, then the energy ends up being 2 epsilon zero. And this wave function is anti-symmetric overall because the spin part is anti-symmetric. And it's going to consist of this singlet state. So again, to write the singlet state, I'm using the Ket notation, and this refers to electron 1, and this refers to electron 2. And same thing here. So if you interchange electron 1 and electron 2, this stays the same. this switches sign. Okay, that's should be clear. And the second case you can have is spatially anti-symmetric. And that you would write down as 1 over root 2, psi 0 of R1, psi 1 of R2, minus psi 1 of R1, psi 0 of R2. And the energy would be epsilon 0 plus epsilon 1. So because the spatially part is anti-symmetric, you can't put both electrons in the same state. You have to move up to the next excited state for one of the two electrons. And you've got this linear combination to make sure that they're indistinguishable, and in this case, anti-symmetric. And they go with a symmetric spin part. But there's a degeneracy here. There are three possibilities. All of which are symmetric. And this is referred to as the triplet, spin triplet. This one here is the spin singlet. This, as you know, probably this has S equals 1, so I'm using 1 times h bar, and these refer to the ladder of S that equals 1, 0, and minus 1. This has S equals 0, and therefore there's only one possible S set value, which is 0. Okay, what are psi 0 and psi 1? And this is where approximations come in. So one possibility is that psi 0 of R1 is equal to phi, I will call it, R1 minus RA plus phi of R2 minus, phi of R1 minus RB. And we'll put a 1 over root 2 here. And that's just saying that the wave function is a linear superposition of, say, an S state around that atom, and then an S state around that atom. And psi 1 would be the same thing, but with a minus sign. Okay, let's be, there's too many wave functions now. This is a two-particle wave function that we're going to refer to more simply as linear superposition of these product states of single particle wave functions. So these are single particle wave functions. Okay, this minus sign has nothing to do with anti-symmetrizing. There's only one electron.
They're one particle wave function, and A and B refer to
the two ions. And this, remember, I start off with an n equals 2 solid. So in your mind, think of n equals 4, 10 to the 23rd, right? So there could be many of these. If there are many of these, then I just go along and move many of these, put in many of these, and similarly here. And these you may or may not recognize as block states for a molecule, because with the block states we had something like that. But if we just do an n equals 2 solid, there are just these two points in the Brillouin zone, okay, which are 0 and pi. And remember, there's an e to the ik, so e to the ik 0 is plus 1, that's here, and e to the ik pi is minus 1. So that's so there are these two points. And again, if we were doing more of these, there would be more terms in this sum. So what do I want to, I should have said right away that if I now examine the splitting between the singlet state energy and the triplet state energy, it's going to simply be epsilon 0 minus epsilon 1. By definition, epsilon 0 is lower in energy than epsilon 1. It's the ground state energy. This is the first excited state. This is negative. And therefore, the singlet state is lower in energy than the triplet state. Okay? This happens to be the right answer. For an n equals 2 situation like this, even including this energy here. Okay, so we haven't included this in this discussion yet, but it happens to be the right answer. So we're getting the right answer. But you can see there's a problem if we write out the wave functions. So let me stay over here. If you write out these wave functions, so the singlet, and I guess I'll write it as psi s bar 1 r 2, then it's equal to, so this is just the spatial part, and you can see, by the way, what's happening here. If this is true, if this is less than 0, then the singlet state is the lowest energy state, and that immediately has implications about the magnetic properties of this state. Okay, that is essentially non-magnetic, or in fact it would be anti-ferromagnetic. Whereas if this was the lowest state, it would definitely have ferromagnetic attributes. Again, we're doing just two atoms, A and B, but if you've got a whole array of these, if you've got an entire solid, then the generalization is that they would all be spin up or all be spin down. So we're only considering the electrostatic Hamiltonian, and it's only because of electrostatics that one of these states will be higher or lower in energy, but whichever one is higher or lower in energy, that immediately implies that that ground state has specific magnetic properties. And that's what's going to show up when you look at magnetic properties. If we now look at this singlet state, so I've got a 1 over root 2, and then I've got a bunch of other 1 over root 2s, so a half. And then I've got phi. Let me write this a little more, in a little bit more shorthand, which is like this. So phi a, so this is what I mean by this is simply R1 minus RA. So it's centered around the ion A. I'll have plus phi B R1, and then this is times phi A R2 plus phi B R2, which is equal to 1 over 2 root 2 times phi A of R1 phi A of R2 plus phi A of R1 times phi B of R2 plus phi B of R1 And if we just look at this pictorially, this part of the wave function represents that. This represents that. This is that, and this one represents that. If we do the same thing for the triplet state, then we have 1 over root 2. So we still have the 1 over root 2, 2. And then we've got a lot more terms, right? We have 2 terms here times 2 terms there minus 2 terms here times 2 terms there. And if I do all this, then if I haven't made a mistake, I will get phi A R1 phi B R2 minus phi B R1 phi A R2. And I think there's no more 2 there. Okay, so these are the 2 states. And again, pictorially, if I look at this, I have that situation. So the problem is, this got me the right answer, as I mentioned, but there's something very wrong about, in particular, this wave function. And what's very wrong is if I imagine that the 2 atoms, A and B, are very far apart, then this wave function says there's equal amplitude for the 2 electrons to be, you know, with the atom in the next room, and no electrons here. Okay, and that's come about because in writing down these states, we basically were ignoring this Coulomb repulsion. Okay, we're doing band theory like we've done before, and we were ignoring the Coulomb repulsion. And that's going to be unphysical. And not only unphysical, but when we turn this up, because we've neglected it up till now, we're eventually clearly going to make this wave function higher in energy than this one. Okay, and that's not correct. We know that the true ground state in this situation of 2 simple atoms like this is going to be a singlet. So what to do about this? And the triplet state doesn't suffer from this defect. It properly has 1 electron associated with each atom.
thing you don't like about the first wave function is that it has part where the two electrons are localized at the same?
Yes. Yes. So just this is called band theory or Hund-Mulliken. And the one I'm going to write down now is called the Heitler-London. So one tact I can take is to just take the good part version of psi SR1, R2. Okay, and what's the good part? The good part is just the terms that involve one electron. So we get 1 over root 2, phi A of R1, phi B of R2, plus phi B of R1, phi A of R2. And I will put the superscripts HL for Heitler-London. How did these guys come up with this? Did they just look at that wave function and lop off those two pieces they didn't like? No, this is obtained from a completely different framework, and ends up being this part with those two pieces lopped off. So from here on in, we're going to deal with these Heitler-London wave functions where the triplet one is identical to the one we had before. I mean, the way Heitler and London came up with this is they went from the other extreme. They imagined these two atoms very far apart. If they're very far apart, then one electron is going to be on one atom and one electron is going to be on the other atom. Oh, but then electron wave functions have to be anti-symmetrized. And so then you're led to taking not just using this piece of the wave function, but symmetrizing it in this case and tagging on the anti-symmetric spin part. And similarly here. If you go back even one step further, you know, you could just say, well, the ground state is clearly, you know, one electron over there with that atom and one electron over here with this atom. But then there are four possibilities for the spin. That can be spin up. This one can be spin up. That could be spin up. This one can be spin down. That can be spin down, spin up, spin down, spin down. And then we sort them, not in that basis, but we sort them according to the singlet triplet formation for two reasons. One reason is these have good quantum numbers in terms of S and SZ, right? And those S's and those SZ totals commute with the Hamiltonian, so that's what you want. That's the first reason. The second reason is the reason we're addressing here is that they actually will differ in energy, those two states, because of this feature that goes along with that, which is that the orbital part is symmetric in one case and anti-symmetric in the other. And one shouldn't be so negative on the Hund-Mulliken or the band theory, right? Because if you now examine, suppose I now bring A and B close together. I've had them in the next room from one another, but suppose I bring them on top of one another. Then the Heitler-London fails completely because it looks like two electrons orbiting a a single nucleus. I'd have to write out the algebra to see it more clearly, of charge E, whereas this band theory result, okay, if the two atoms come close together, then what is clear from this band theory result is that the electrons are now attracted to a nucleus of charge 2e, which is the correct answer, because when the two atoms, if the two protons come together, then that now looks like a helium, a single helium atom, not sort of two individual hydrogen atoms, which is what you get out of these Heitler-London wave functions. So the band theory tends to work when when kinetic energy dominates electron interactions, and the Heitler-London theory tends to dominate in the opposite regime. Okay, so now if you use these, so use Psi Heitler-London, singlet and triplet, to compute ES minus ET. So I'm gonna, if you do that, you will get U minus V SAB squared over 1 minus SAB squared, where SAB is simply the overlap. So this is a wave function, say an S state, centered around the atom A. This is a wave function, the same wave function like an S state, centered around the atom B. So if these are in the next room from one another, these are clearly zero. Whereas if you bring the atoms closer together, these are actually non-zero. Okay, so even though I put 1 over root 2s up there, you shouldn't have been lulled into thinking that those phis were orthonormal to one another. They're not. Yes.
What are the U? What's U and V?
I didn't know. So U is the direct overlap. So it will be this times a bunch of stuff, and here in particular there'll be the E squared over R1 minus R2. So this is the Coulomb repulsion that we've been leaving out until now. It will include the E squared over R1 minus R2, which I didn't even put in the Hamiltonian because we were using the Born-Oppenheimer approximation, so that Coulomb repulsion between the two atoms themselves is just sort of a constant as far as the quantum mechanics is concerned. But we'll put it in here now. And then we have minus E squared R1, and I've lapsed into the, this should be A and B, R1 minus RB minus E squared over R2 minus RA. And this is called the direct Coulomb repulsion. Okay, you see phi star of R1 and phi of R1 both centered around A. That's the charge density, right? This and this is simply that. And then the other term is the same thing for R2. So that looks like your classical Coulomb repulsion between two electrons. And V is the exchange term. And it's called the exchange term because over here, R1 and R2, the two electrons have been exchanged. Okay, so these are not the same. You can't write it as a charge density like that because, you know, now you have phi of R1 minus RA star over there, and over here you've got phi of R1 minus RB. And something similar for R2. So you can't write that in any classical way. Yes, Eugene?
In the definition of the U, you have R1 minus RB. And
yes.
Yeah, but the wave functions are like phi of, I thought maybe the A electron was near, so closer to the RA.
The R1 is closer to RA? No, you're distinguishing the two electrons when you say that, right? It's that's why I changed notation and put A and B, because this part of the wave function says R1 is close to uppercase RA, but this part of the wave function says R1 is closer to uppercase RB, and they're both equally probable. One thing, the thing in brackets here is not the same. It's e squared. This part is the same. But this is R1 minus RA now. And that's referred to as the exchange term. So this doesn't show up except that you're doing, A, you're doing quantum mechanics, and B, what I think of is it's a working hypothesis between beyond quantum mechanics that particles in this universe are indistinguishable. And therefore, we've separated them out into fermions and bosons that have anti-symmetric and symmetric wave functions, respectively. And some of you may know that people are working on generalizations of that to what are called anion statistics, which involve a phase change when you interchange particles, not just plus or minus one. That's beyond quantum mechanics. It's an additional hypothesis, and it's because of that that we end up with this exchange term, which now says that this splitting between the singlet and the triplet. So the triplets, there are three of them, but they will remain degenerate because there's nothing in the Hamiltonian specifically addressing the spin. Hamiltonian couldn't care less what the spin is. The Hamiltonian cares about what this configuration is, and it's the same for all three of those spin states. So that remains degenerate, and so this splitting though is now given by this expression, at least for the Heitler-London wave functions. These are not exact, right? But now you can start discussing. So very often, what's given in I think in Ashcroft and Merman, all that's given is U. No. In Ashcroft and Merman. Actually, in Ashcroft and Merman, I think all it's given is the minus V times 1. Times 1, times S squared, where S is some very small value. So, but in general, this is given by, and it's defined to be J. And J is referred to as the exchange. And when you, so, well, let's proceed further before I make further statements. So what you would now like to do is have a simpler theory. When I have these two electron systems, I've got a whole spectrum of energies. And I have fixated really on the low-lying states. And indeed, when you're at low energy, at low temperature, you need only fixate on those states. And you want to distinguish now between this situation. So this is ES and this is E triplet versus this situation, where this is ES and this is E triplet. You've already decided that, or you know that nature has decided that the states involved in this problem are going to be something like these states, as opposed to states that are way up there in energy, right? Because there's going to be lots of excited states associated with the spatial part of the wave function, much higher in energy. But if the temperature scale, for example, is you know, basically two or three times this splitting, then the fact that there are states with energy up at the top of the board, we don't care. They're kind of not going to be accessed in any measurement because the temperature is too low. So we want to fixate on this, and we want to write down an effective Hamiltonian which discriminates between psi s and psi t. Okay, so that's the strategy. And
why?
Yeah. To make the problem simpler.
No, but our interest is that the first case where the triplet is the lower energy state, so I can have some spin and magnetic properties. That would be the whole idea.
Yes. So if it's this, it's basically ferromagnetic. Whereas if it's this, it's anti-ferromagnetic.
And I want to find an effective Hamiltonian that tells me, well, I'm here.
Or I have this situation, or I have that situation. Because right now, I have to do these. If I want to do this from first principles, I have to do these calculations. These are quantum chemistry, and in a solid, they're almost certainly going to be wrong. Okay, because in a solid, you don't just have two atoms by themselves where you can do nice quantum chemistry on it. They're inside a solid, and there's what's referred to as a crystal field, which is sort of the field that two electrons would feel surrounding two atoms in a solid because of all the other atoms that are around. So there are too many complicating effects to try and calculate this from first principles. But we want to, and we want to understand, you know, we want to simplify the problem. We don't want to do quantum chemistry all our lives. We want to stop doing that and do something simpler. And ultimately, yeah, it's what I just said. These are two states. Four, if you include the degeneracy. They're four states. You'd like to have the problem reduced to studying four states, not the infinite number of Rydberg states that are associated with electrons orbiting an atom, right? Because right now I've focused on what might be the 1s state or something, but there's the 2s and everything else. So in doing this, in carrying out this program, we want to focus on invariance or constants of the motion, and the obvious two here are what I'll call S total, which is S1 plus S2 in this case. If we're doing a solid, it would be the sum of these, and SZ total, which is SZ1 plus SZ2. Where these are the spin operators, okay, from angular momentum theory, and these are spin half electrons. So what you know is that, you can verify if you wish, but you know S total squared commutes with the Hamiltonian, and SZ total commutes with the Hamiltonian. Now you can take S total squared and operate on psi singlet. This is, this is true in general, not just for the Heitler-London. And what will you get for this? You get zero. Whereas if you operate on the triplet, you get, let me put the h bar squared, s times s plus 1. S is 1 here, right? The psi s total for the triplet states is 1, 1 times h bar. And so you get 2. So these discriminate between those two states. So that means we should use those. But what's S total? Well, S total itself as an operator is S1 dot S2. S1 plus S2 dot S1 plus S2. That's what S total is. And that is S1 squared, that's an operator, plus S2 squared plus 2 times S1 dot S2. But the fact that S1 squared is operating on electron 1 doesn't matter. It's an electron, right? So this is S times S plus 1, but S now is the electron S, which is a half. So a half times half plus 1 is 3/4. And so is this. So we end up with 3/2 times 2 S1 dot S2. So since it's S total that discriminates these two, and S total is proportional to a constant and times something times S dot S2, S1 dot S2, this suggests that H effective is equal to a constant plus another constant times S1 dot S2. Because H effective on psi S, we want a Hamiltonian that returns us the correct ground state energy, which is E sub S, on the one hand. On the other hand, it returns us A plus B times S1 dot S2 acting on psi S. But what does S1 dot S2 acting on psi S give us? Well, this relation tells us S total squared is 3/2 plus 2 times S1 dot S2. But if we now act on psi S, S total acting on psi S is 0, is equal to 3/2 acting on psi S plus 2 dot. So this implies S1 dot S2 acting on psi S is minus 3/4 acting on psi S. Right? So I put minus 3/4 here. And then this gives me psi S. If I do the same thing, but act on the triplet state, I get A, and then I use this again to tell me, well, S total acting on the triplet gave me 2. So now I take 2, take away 3/2, that gives me 1/2, divide by 2. So S1 dot S2 acting on the triplet is 1/4 on the triplet. So down here I get A plus B times 1/4 acting on psi T. Well, this is two unknowns, A and B, in terms of ES and ET. So if I subtract these two equations, I get that B is equal to ET minus ES. And I get that A is equal to 3/4 ES plus ET plus 3 ET divided by 4. So then I can write that H effective is now some constant, which we're not going to care about. Minus ES minus ET . So I flip the sign and put a minus sign, S1 dot S2. And this is what up there we define to be J. So H effective is minus J S1 dot S2. This is essentially the derivation Heisenberg did, except now he generalized it to a solid and basically said that we can describe the Hamiltonian in an insulating system as an interaction between two spin operators. Okay, so, and going back to the Heitler-London ideas, which remember, this is where the atoms are far apart. When the atoms are far apart, you're describing an insulating situation. If I have one atom here and one atom in the next room, there's no way the electron that's associated with the atom here is going to hop and end up over on that atom. As I bring them closer together, at the angstrom level, then I might start getting some conduction. So as I started out at the beginning, when they were in two different rooms, there was a fourfold degeneracy. And there was nothing to tell you what the spin configuration should be if you didn't think about it. If you think about it and just go through this exercise, which is what we just did, then this tells you, aha, there is something that discriminates between that fourfold degeneracy in the case of two atoms. And this is for the whole atom. So if I've got an entire solid of 10 to the 23rd atoms, and it's insulating, at first glance, I can just randomly put down single electrons that are tied to each site. They're localized at each site. But with a mindless assignment of spin. This tells you, no, it's not mindless. If J is greater than zero, then this is all going to be, they're all going to be aligned. Okay, which I don't know if that's obvious to you now. And if J is less than zero, then they're going to alternate like this. And that discriminates between, remember, with two atoms, there was a fourfold degeneracy. With three atoms, there's an eightfold degeneracy. With n atoms, there's a 2 to the n fold degeneracy. There's a huge, huge degeneracy. This breaks that degeneracy and tells you how it goes. Are these states obvious? Do they follow obviously from here? I see one nodding, which is not nodding off to sleep. It's a yes. Yeah.
Given that maybe the J is not homogeneous for any pair A or J.
Nearest
neighbor only. Thank you.
So yeah, the ground state is going to be.
Then it comes out as a constant, assuming it's homogeneous everywhere. Thank you for fixing that. Okay, so. It's actually not that obvious. And the reason why I can tell you right away it's not that obvious is because this state is correct and obvious in hindsight. This state is completely wrong. It's not even an eigenstate. Okay, this is what is referred to as the Nail state. And it's basically classical. I want to describe a bit of the history in a second, so I will come to that again. Well,
I guess
it's because. Pardon?
Yeah, that's. That's because the Heisenberg model, right? It's a vector, so you can, if it were just a Heisenberg model,
that's right.
Then that would be
yes.
Correct.
Okay. That's right. So not because it's a vector, because it's an operator. So if
but
I write,
but it's a vector operator. I just seem to recall it the way one shows that this is not the, like this is not a possible eigenstate or ground state. It's by essentially you can rotate the, you can rotate that state, and then it becomes, you get a contradiction. Like if it's a ground state in one.
I see.
Maybe I'm wrong.
No, you're probably right, but that's not how I. I'll show you how I see
sure.
it. This, what is this? This is SIX times SJX plus SIY times SJY plus SIZ. So it's minus J times the sum over I. Let me, these angular brackets mean that J is close to I. So I'm going to use delta as connecting I and J. So it's SIZ, SI plus delta Z. And we only count this once. These are nearest neighbors, but we're only going to count it once. It's got to be understood. So when we're going through this lattice, we count that and that, but we don't count backwards, because when we were here, we counted that and that. And then here, it's those other two terms, but the way I prefer to write them is with the raising and lowering operators. Okay, where S plus or minus is equal to SX plus or minus ISY. So these are operators. And what this is what Olivier already said was the Ising model. Okay, and but these are sort of and that's referred to as a classical Hamiltonian. These are often talked about as quantum fluctuations. If we had this state here, and think about mentally going over all the sites, this just counts up the number of bonds that are ferromagnetically aligned and assigns a value of a half times a half, if they're spin a half objects, so a quarter. And then it finds the ones that are anti-ferromagnetically aligned and assigns minus a quarter, because a half times minus a half, or vice versa. And of course, here there are no anti-ferromagnetically aligned ones, so you just get the full brunt of this, which is great if J is positive, because there's a minus sign out here. But these ones, and so they do nothing to the state. That's why they're considered classical. They just interrogate the state. These ones, on the other hand, do something to the state. This one flips down one of the spins, but then it takes its neighbor and raises it. Well, and this one does vice versa. Well, if you've got this state, these terms give zero. You can't raise something that's already fully raised. So these terms give zero. And so when you operate with this Hamiltonian on this state, you get back that state with an energy which is, I would say, clearly the lowest energy. And that's, so it's an eigenstate, and it's the ground state. When you do the same thing with this state, then again, you will get the maximal amount here. You'll get your minus a quarter for every single bond, because they're all anti-ferromagnetically aligned. That's great. But these operators come along and they take a pair like this pair, and they flip them. Okay, they actually flip them. And so when you operate with this Hamiltonian on this state, you don't get back this state. You get back a state that's been modified. And so it's not even an eigenstate. Nonetheless, this nail state with what's referred to as a staggered magnetization. So it's staggered because it's up, down, up, down. And you can have more complicated staggerings because it could be waving up, down on a, you know, on a much longer length scale than just nearest neighbor. But that's that magnetization or staggered magnetization is something that people are very much interested in, which I will briefly go through. So let me, can I have the, thank you, the slide. So this Heisenberg Hamiltonian has become a complete industry. It's something that's studied by a research community almost exclusively. So they don't worry about any of the other issues we've talked about, but they're more interested in how this Heisenberg model occurs or impacts properties and materials. And the way we've gone through a very rudimentary derivation, people typically take a solid that's known to exist in nature and they examine the low-lying levels and then they do the same kind of mapping I did here, but sometimes you want to add a term proportional to SIZ squared, for example. Why? Because you know from the electronic structure of the material that the spins want to lie in a plane, not in the Z direction, given a particular direction in the crystal. And so you penalize the Z direction by an amount D being positive. Okay, right, so this is a slide I prepared on a transparency 20 years ago or so, and I just thought I would run through it for a second. So Olivier mentioned the Ising model. That was done in 1925 and was considered a complete failure. He basically left physics.
What?
He left physics because he was given this problem by Lenz, I think, and he was looking for an explanation for ferromagnetism, and he did the one-dimensional Ising model, found no phase transition, nothing happening. So it was considered a failure. It was just, he wrote it up and published it, and I believe he became a high school teacher.
We are here talking about the Ising
model. Yeah, no, it's pretty impressive.
So it took somebody to solve it in 2D before people realized that it was like meaningful.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, so the 2D, so this was just prepared for the 1D. 1D quantum antiferromagnet, but I'll say something about higher dimensions. So since you mentioned it, yeah, after 1925, basically you jump to 1941, and Kramers and Vanier constructed an argument for the two-dimensional Ising model that said there was a transition temperature, non-zero transition temperature, and they calculated it, and they got it right.
Was mean field theory happened before that? Like mean field theory solution?
Yes, the Curry-Weiss stuff was much before that, but no one necessarily believed it.
Okay.
This is an exact solution.
Yeah.
Because you can do Curry-Weiss on the 1D Ising and get a nice transition.
Well, yeah, so that's what I... I mean, before you leave physics, I would be like, well, it works in the, you know, in the mean field approximation. China.
No, no, but this, Ising did an exact solution.
Yeah, I know, I know. But, okay.
So if you've got the exact solution, all that does is,
well,
is destroy your...
Okay, I guess it tells you that the mean field theory...
So yeah, it destroys your confidence in the mean field approximation, right? And so why should you believe it in 2D?
Yeah, that's true.
And remember, in those days, in particular, the understanding of how dimensionality played a role in phase transitions wasn't there. I mean, who's to say? These are very local models. It doesn't look like there should be any differences between 1D, 2D, and 3D. So these guys in 41 did this very nice piece of work. And then Ansager, I don't know if any of you have heard of Ansager. He was apparently quite a character. Again, these people that are always made fun of because they win Nobel Prizes in chemistry. He won one in chemistry, not for this. I mean, he did amazing things in chemistry too. But he was, so apparently, this is what I've read and I've been told as well, he was giving a talk at a conference, and someone asked him a question, and he said, well, I know that the partition function goes like this, so therefore this must be the answer. It was about the Ising model. And then the guy in the audience, well, wait a minute, what do you mean you know? If you know that, then you know the partition function. And he said, yeah, I calculated it. To which the guy responded, you know, this is like a huge breakthrough. You've calculated the partition function? And he kept it to himself for several years. just sort of, I don't know, he did eventually publish it in 42. And actually, a student of his, Hoffman, Laura? No, forget the first name, but Hoffman's her last name. And he published something in 1949, like a full-blown partition function for this model. So many years later. But he just seemed to be one of those guys who didn't worry too much about getting credit for something, which is refreshing. So, but let me back up, because to me this is, I methany of you have heard of Hans Bethe, because he did a lot of work in all areas of physics, but in particular in the last 30 years, up to when he died, in nuclear astrophysics. I mean, he's primarily known as a nuclear physicist, and then he went into nuclear astrophysics. But in 1931, he was visiting Rome, and I guess somebody there wanted him to look at this problem. He looked at the one-dimensional, so just the one-dimensional Heisenberg model, this thing, okay, anti-ferromagnet. Like, the ferromagnet, I just told you what the ground state is. I mean, how hard can it be? You're just switching the sign of the parameter in front. How hard can it be? It's extremely hard, as it turns out. But in 1931, he solved this problem exactly with what's known as the Bethe ansatz, which, starting in the early 60s, became a complete industry and remains a complete industry to this day of people doing Bethe ansatz solutions for various models, even beyond Heisenberg model. There are these things called vertex models. In fact, people here in Waterloo are known for addressing some of these problems. You may have heard of monopoles being discovered in condensed matter systems, which is just a flowery way of describing some of the things that are going on in condensed matter, but in these spin chains in particular, that start resembling monopoles. So that's why they color it up like that. But I'm getting ahead. So this almost remains the only real many-body problem that's ever been solved. And it's a real tour de force. It's an incredible piece of work. It's in German, but there are translations. And this is in Danish, I think. But there are translations for this as well. This guy actually calculated the ground state. Beta came up with the wave function. And then this guy calculated the ground state. And then we move ahead to 1952. And we'll talk about spin wave theory in a little bit. But Phil Anderson was the first to do this. And this is where dimensionality started to rear its head. He basically did a calculation of the excitation spectrum and noticed that in 1D and in 2D, it diverges. And so basically you're doing mean field theory. So you do mean field theory, you get the ground state, but then you look at the excitations beyond the ground state. And if the excitations start to diverge on you, that makes you think, well, the ground state might not have been right. And so this led to the notion, it was that in one and two dimensions, this Nail state that looks so appealing and is based on just this, won't necessarily survive. So the issue is, when you include the full Hamiltonian, you don't just do the Ising model. This, of course, is a ferromagnet, with and without. This, on the other hand, is the staggered magnetization, as measured by alternating, you know, this is like a sum over all the SIZs, but with a minus one to the I, so it'll go plus, minus. Is that zero or not zero? If it's not zero, then there is a remnant of this picture in the true ground state. And there's a remnant of long range order, right? Because this is up, down, but it's still very ordered. And if this is non-zero, then this picture kind of will hold. And what Anderson did was discover that these fluctuations, so this is like a perturbation calculation or beyond mean field slightly, diverge in one and two dimensions. Now in one dimension, Beta had already solved this problem, and in the Beta ansatz, which is exact in 1D, there is no staggered magnetization. This is, if you just have a one-dimensional chain, then the true ground state has no remnant of this up-down, long-range order. It has a remnant in the sense of short range, but there's no long-range order. But what about 2D? So Anderson basically at the time calculated the staggered magnetization, and it's reduced. It's non-zero, but it's reduced from what you get here. Later on, he suggested that it would be reduced to zero if you did a full-blown calculation. In the late 80s, this became a big topic of heightened interest because of superconductivity at the time, because it seemed to be connected to the superconductivity and the cuprates. And so again, a bunch of people did some very definitive calculations and discovered that there indeed is a staggered magnetization for the two-dimensional square lattice. Of course, so that's the definitive answer now. But once you have that answer, you can go back to not this Hamiltonian, but this one and say, what about if there are next nearest neighbor interactions? So what if there is a J1 between here and here and a J2 between here and here, both of which are positive? Now you're frustrated, and these are referred to as frustrated systems, because given that this is up, you'd like this one to be down, but given that this is up, you would like this one to be down, but given that this is down, you'd like this one to be up. And so there's again a whole industry on studying frustrated systems like this, and it turns out to be phase transitions, as you might imagine, as a function of J2 growing from zero. And not only that, but if you suppose you have a triangular lattice, then you've got frustration from the get-go, because if this is up and that's down because it's the nearest neighbor of that, what's that? This guy says it should be down, this guy says it should be up. And so people study all sorts of problems like that. But that's in two dimensions. Then there were various calculations of the spectrum, these spin waves that Anderson derived. And this paper in 1962 is a particular note, because we're going to do spin wave theory probably in the next lecture, but and what are spin waves? Let me tell you what spin waves are. It's easiest to think of them from a ferromagnet. There's your ground state, right? It goes on forever, whether it's one dimension, two dimensions, or three dimensions. What's your first excitation? Well, what's going to be the lowest excitation? Yeah, one of them is just going to be flipped. If these are spin a half, then all it can do is flip over. If they're higher spin, they can ratchet down. But it's called a spin wave. So, and you've all had Bloch's theorem drilled into you. So obviously a spin wave is just a wave of these excitations. Because this could be here, could be here, could be here. And then you'd simply take a Bloch state of those superpositions, e to the ik dot r. That's what a spin wave is. And de Clauseau and Pearson in 1D looked at as a function of q, and they said the spin wave spectrum will look like this. Okay, so it goes to zero. Actually, I think it goes to zero quadratically, and it's symmetric. Oh, this is pi over a in the Brillouin zone. So this is the spin wave, and it looks something like that. And what they said this was a linear superposition of these, and that's what everybody believed for about 20 years. Yes, Fiona?
And when you said take the Bloch state, do you mean like just periodically put this in or something like that?
I mean 1 over square root of n, sum over I, e to the I, q dot r I times si minus. So the si minus lowers the spin at site I. But I now take a linear superposition of it being lowered here, 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 and here. That's what I mean.
Oh, yeah, I see.
Okay. This turned out to be wrong. This, because it's 1D again, it seems to be right in 2D and 3D, but it's 1D that's very special. This turns out to be, how does it go? Something like this. This turns out to be just the bottom edge of a continuum of excitations. So the notion, because people, as soon as you predict a branch of excitations like that, what does this remind you of? It reminds you of phonons in regular solids. How do you look for phonons? You do neutron scattering. You can do the same for spin waves. And people did neutron scattering, and they saw this branch. And they said, okay, the theory is great. It works. But the neutron scattering wasn't accurate enough to distinguish a peak down here versus a edge of a continuum, because in the actual 1D theory, this, if I cut here, you've got a, so there's energy, how do I want to draw energy this way, here's the bottom, so that's right there, E1, and here's the top, E2. So here's E1, here's E2. It turns out that there's a singularity in the spectrum. So it's a continuous spectrum, and it ends, I think there's a continuous singularity there as well. So they were measuring this, and as you saw from those phonon spectra that were measured, they're not perfect delta functions. They look like nice peaks. This looked like a nice peak at first, until they could improve the accuracy and determine that it was lower branch of a 2-magnon spectrum. And that was basically these guys jumping down. These guys pointed out that that's not just a simple spin wave, but actually there are things called spin-ons. Spin-ons and hole-ons are, again, jargon that actually, I can tell you what spin-ons and hole-ons are with a picture. This is all for anti-ferromagnets, right? So here is... Here's your nail state. It's a cartoon. Now I think of an excitation which flips one of these. And I get that situation, right? But if you look at the Hamiltonian, it's got these S plus, S minus operators that operate on neighboring sites. So that Hamiltonian can take this this pair and flip them. So if I take that pair and flip them, I get this, 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 this. And then I can take, you know, I started with this. There's a lower energy excitation, which is to remove the spin altogether. If I remove the spin altogether, I leave an empty space there. Okay, and that's what's referred to as a holon. So I get this picture, and then if I spin flip again, like this pair, I get this picture. What's happening here? What's happening, although you might not see it because I should have used colored chalk, is there is There is a set of spins which are a defect. They're parallel to one another. And they're moving. They're moving through the Hamiltonian dynamics, because all I'm doing is applying the Hamiltonian here. They're actually moving in this lattice. And that entity is called a spin-on. And independently of that, this entity can move. Right? Because if it moves there, then this guy goes there, and now you've got anti-alignment, and that's all good. So this holon spin-on pair are independent objects. And what people realized after this is that the excitations, the excitation spectrum in a one-dimensional solid in particular is broken up. It's broken up into a spin part, and it's broken up into a charge part. This absence of a spin here is charge, but there are no spin attributes. So these are all electrons to start with. An electron has charge and it has spin. And you know where the electron goes, the charge and the spin go. But in this situation, this is referred to as spin-charge separation. The spin degree of freedom has separated from the charge degree of freedom. And that has important ramifications for various theories. I could go on at length here. I just comment, this is one of the two papers, key papers, that Haldane won the Nobel Prize this year. And this is where, again, with just a simple spin chain like this, he said there's a tremendous difference between the excitation spectrum of a spin chain that had half integer spin versus a spin chain that had integer spin. And the experiments to show that he was right were done here in Canada. Okay, I have run out of time. Let me just, I'll show these pictures so I don't have to show them next time. This is because we're going to talk about ordered states now and mean field theory and spin wave theory, basically. So there, these figures from Ashcroft to show you various ordered states, including, you know, Fairy magnetism and canted spins. So Fairy magnetism is something like described down here. And this is the domain structure I told you about that comes about because of the actual dipole-dipole magnetic interactions. And we won't talk about that at all. This is just the table trying, just to give you an idea of the temperatures involved. Remember I mentioned they were thousands of degrees for the Curie temperature. And like iron is one of the most common ones, and that's over 1,000 degrees. And that's why that dipole-dipole interaction wasn't going to explain that. And this is to show you that in the case of antiferromagnetism, they're by and large lower. They're not, there's one up at 600 there, but they're generally almost lower, almost by an order of magnitude, which tells you something about the nature of the interactions. And then this slide just tells you that you can see ordering transitions. So they can actually measure where something orders, whether it's a ferromagnet, which is relatively easy, or, as in this case, an antiferromagnet. And for an antiferromagnet, you need neutrons, basically, because you need to see when you've got a situation like this, which is the same across all space, that corresponds roughly to Q equals zero in wave vector space. When you've got something staggered like this, then the Q involved here is basically connected to the wavelength. And because the wavelength here is basically just one lattice spacing, the Q is pi over A. So you really have to get into the Brillouin zone, and the only way to do that is with neutrons. And finally, what I derive next class is this T, Bloch's T to the 3/2 law. So this is the deviation of the magnetization from its full value at zero temperature as a function of temperature. Mean field theory gives you an exponential the small decrease, whereas spin wave theory gives you this T to the 3/2. Okay, so next class we'll start with mean field theory. I'll do mean field theory quickly just to show you how it's done, and then we'll do a more accurate calculation for the excitations off of mean field theory.